It's the 21st of June 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is the American ruling on gene patenting sensible or patently ridiculous? What's on Girl with a One-Track Mind's mind? If there's an app that claims to cure gay people, does it work on androids? Are the chief rabbi's opinions about atheism kosher? And is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's something that looks quite a lot like Jesus. Now, before we begin, the traditional begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start the show this week with news from America about the patenting of genes. The Supreme Court made a hugely important ruling this week that could massively affect the growing synthetic biology industry. To explain more, here's Julie Gould.
DNA, the building blocks of life, are what make up each and every one of us, what make us who we are, and what makes us unique. So how would you feel if someone owned a piece, a genetic sequence of your DNA? And what does that even mean? On Thursday, the 13th of June, the US Supreme Court ruled that naturally occurring human genetic sequences could not be patented. What consequences does this decision have on our identity, on natural processes, and importantly, on biotechnology research and industry? I've come to London to meet Dr. Shiva Tambasetti, an expert in biotechnology patent law from London School of Economics, to find out more.
My first question to you is, what does it actually mean to be able to patent human genes?
It's a very interesting question and really goes to the crux of this decision, because the answer depends somewhat on whether you're a geneticist or a biochemist. And I think this decision really is about genetics trumping chemistry in some way. So when you talk about a patent on a human gene, it doesn't mean that they own a part of you or the gene that exists in you. What they own is the sequence as it is isolated from nature. So for instance, if I was to walk on the park and come across a shiny stone, and I pick up the stone and I take it home and I wash it and I polish it, it then becomes something new and different from the stone that was on the path, which would have been a naturally occurring stone. It's this process of isolation or purification that allows a naturally occurring gene to be patented in the US up until this decision. So it's the process of isolation and purification that now the Supreme Court has said can no longer make a gene novel or new.
I also spoke to Rob Carson, founder of Biodesic, a synthetic biology company based in the States. He's been playing with synthetic biology for a while and has been thinking about the patent laws and consequences at the same time.
So why is this story in particular with Myriad become such a big deal?
Well, part of it is it's human health. Myriad was effectively standing in the way of other people offering less expensive assays for genes that are correlated with breast cancer, which means that you could only have the assay to find out if you were susceptible to breast cancer if you paid Myriad a substantial fee. And they were very aggressive about preventing other people from offering competing assays. And they still have a patent on the specific kind of assay that involves the cDNA, complementary DNA, that they have the patent for. But they can no longer prevent people from developing other kinds of assays that might be based on the naturally occurring sequence.
So the BRCA genes that Myriad identified and wanted to patent, the human intervention was that they found and isolated this particular gene. The Supreme Court now said that does not count. You cannot patent that gene just because you intervened and separated it and isolated it. But what sort of level of human intervention is considered patentable?
DNA that is in the human body can't be patented. So the naturally occurring molecule is not patentable. The RNA that's derived from the naturally occurring molecule is not patentable. What Myriad did that is patentable was they took the RNA and edited the RNA and turned it back into a piece of DNA. So because they edited the sequence and they took out some bits and stitched it all back together again, the new sequence, the new thing, it is patentable. And those same rules apply to DNA that was synthesized from scratch.
So it's more the process that's allowed to be patented.
So here's a confusion that a lot of people make about this decision. A process can be patented. So the specific process that Myriad used to make the cDNA can be patented. But the cDNA itself, the molecule, can also be patented. And those are two different kinds of patents. There's something called a methods patent, a process patent. And then there's a composition of matter patent. And the composition of matter patent is about chemistry, basically. And because the new DNA was the result of doing chemistry and making an actual physical molecule, the piece of DNA that had never existed in nature before, that molecule can be patented. The methods patents to make DNA are expired at this point, or they're about to expire. So any ability of a company to control the basic technology of turning electronic information into synthetic DNA is probably about to go into the public domain.
The people who are researching in biotechnology, what implications does this decision have on them?
Well, it has different implications for different people. If you have a patent on a naturally occurring gene, that's no longer valid. But it opens up all the rest of naturally occurring DNA for anybody who wants to play with it and develop an assay or use it in a product in some way, or to produce a product in some way.
So it's going to open a lot of doors for people.
Well, I hope that's true.
So although there might be some hope that this new decision by the US Supreme Court would open some more doors, Shiva says that we should still be a little bit cautious, as there are some consequences that need to be considered.
Here's what the decision actually tells us. The decision actually tells us that there needs to be a bit of nuance in how you approach this. And we need to remember that the Supreme Court was only talking about novelty, which is one patentability criteria. There are others, perhaps could be more relevant now that the Supreme Court has given this decision. For instance, the inventive step standard is, I believe, now going to get very important. So I think a lot of the attention is now going to go to how routine is it to make cDNA, or how routine is it to convert naturally occurring genes into a usable form. Now, some parts of the industry have been very happy with the decision, but I think a little bit more caution is required, because cDNA can also be worked around. You can make different versions of cDNA that would perform the same function, which means that if you have a patent on a cDNA, it doesn't mean that you can then go ahead and aggressively exploit it. You could still be subject to a lot of competitive pressure. So I think the implications of the decision are still to be worked out, but certainly the most important thing is that the U.S. Patent Office, a day after the decision came out, has already put out a note saying that naturally occurring genes are no longer patent eligible. And I think for one section of observers of the patent system and of biotechnology, that is a huge success.
Okay, so we've talked about what effect it'll have on the biotechnology industry, but what about the biotechnology research that happens in the U.S.? What effect does it have on that?
Academic researchers can probably breathe a sigh of relief that no one's going to come after them in their own laboratories. But once they start thinking of applications or uses of their technology, then they are in the field like anybody else in the industry. So I don't think this is going to massively increase the freedom to operate for academic researchers, but it will free up certain kinds of concerns for a very specific group of researchers, yes.
I've read that in Australia, the human genetic sequences are allowed to be patented. So this is the opposite to what the US Supreme Court has ruled. Now, why is this patent law different? Why is it not the same internationally all over the world?
It has been the same until this decision. In most patent systems as we know them, a naturally occurring substance, as long as it's isolated and purified, is patentable. What the Supreme Court decision in the US now says is that they will look closely at the degree of human intervention. If it's simple isolation and purification, it's not patentable. But if you've changed it, then it becomes patentable. The law before the decision is by and large what is practiced all over the world. And therefore, this decision could also have repercussions for natural substances. So for example, a naturally therapeutic substance found in a plant, which has been known traditionally to work for a certain illness or a certain condition, can in most patent systems be patented as long as it's isolated and purified and made available in an active ingredient form. But this decision casts doubt on those kinds of discoveries as well. In response to your specific question, the law is the same across the world in terms of the patentability of naturally occurring genes. The US Supreme Court decision therefore sets up a big point of departure for US patent applications. And it would be interesting to see how institutions like the UK Patent Office or the European Patent Office now responds to this decision. An important inter-organizational dynamic exists between patent offices. So the US Patent Office, the European Patent Office, the Japanese Patent Office negotiate in international fora as one party. They call themselves the trilateral office, and they often inform each other's patent practices. So I think the real interesting work is going to have to be done at this level, where patent offices are going to have to respond to this decision in order to come up with some sort of uniform way of responding to these inventions.
So the overall effect of this decision by the US Supreme Court is still unknown, and will probably be unknown for a while to come. But it'll be interesting to see how the patent laws and the industry and the science develops as a result. This has been Julie Gould reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, it was the British Humanist Association's annual conference up in Leeds. And as you might expect, we were there to do recordings and stuff. So over the next few weeks, check out the Pod Delusion website to download podcasts of most of the talks from the weekend. Whilst there, we also got a chance to have a chat with a few other guests, one of whom was Zoe Margolis, perhaps better known as the Girl with a One-Track Mind. She was one of the first well-known anonymous sex bloggers and was outed by the Sunday Times a few years ago. After her talk, Liz Luckendorf had a chance to have a brief chat. Here she is.
I found it interesting you talked about libel reform and kind of the, you brought a case against them but also support libel reform. Were you interested in all that sort of stuff beforehand, or did your own experiences kind of lead you down that path?
It's really funny because I always supported libel reform, and I was, you know, early groups, you know, a few years ago being sort of active and sort of participating in it, and hadn't ever expected myself to ever be in a legal case that involved me using libel against a company. Mm-hmm. And felt slightly awkward about doing so given my beliefs on it, but then also feeling that, you know, this is me, an individual, a person holding a mass media company to account, and it was really important that I did that, and it wasn't about restricting freedom of speech or being a libel tourist anyway. It was about protecting something really important, which was about women's sexuality and how women are portrayed in the media and how they need to make sure they don't do things like that.
Well, several of the things you mentioned was your experience in the film industry, which sounds horrifying. It seems like there must be loads of court cases there somehow, like under the table, because obviously all the Equalities Act still apply to filmmaking in the UK, but they just don't seem to pay attention to them.
I don't quite know what the problem is. I mean, I would argue that it's people are very fearful, and it's a industry which isn't completely unstable in this country anyway. Mm. It's not very well funded, and we're very dependent on American income. And the rules and regulations that come with that, like, for example, when you work for an American studio here in the UK, you have to sign an agreement with them saying that you give up your right to union representation.
Wow. Okay,
which is ironic given that every film in America is completely unionized. So they can come and they can exploit the workers here entirely. So you immediately give up your rights for any, of any representation. So you have no power. And I would think that in itself is very undermining as a person working in the industry, that you know that you've got no real support, no real backup. I mean, not all areas of the industry aren't allowed to be unionised. There are some technical things like the carpenters who have a very strong union. But for much of it, it's as I said, you sign your contract, you actually give up your right to it. And I think that because of the freelance nature of it and the short-term contracts that people are on, everyone is very fearful for their jobs, you know, and very dependent on the American studios coming here and hiring them. So no one's willing to speak up about it. It's very scary, but then, you know, job instability is the same across all industries.
Yeah. I don't know your case that well, but after you were outed by the Sunday Times, were you surprised in terms of where you found support in unexpected places, or vice versa, where you found kind of antagonists, where you thought you'd find support?
I actually was very surprised at the areas that I found support, that I had been blogging for a number of years and always felt there was, you know, a very close community of people, you know, back in the day. There weren't millions and millions of blogs, there were only thousands, and so people sort of knew each other online, and so there was a lot of support there. But where the support came that I hadn't expected it to come from were from bloggers who had very openly stated prior to my experience of being outed by the Sunday Times that they didn't like my blog, they didn't like what I was writing about, they didn't particularly like me. But post-outing, they still said that, but they said, however, I stand up for her right to remain anonymous, and that the media has no right to out people at whim for their own uses and their own advantages. And so there was this community of people who, on principle, supported me because I was a blogger, and it felt like if they can get one of us, they can get all of us, that we're all at risk. And there's a kind of blogger's ethics code that we all abided by, which was protect your fellow bloggers. You know, it's a good thing to do to make sure that we all have the freedom to express ourselves without being censored or being fearful or you know, worrying about judgment. So there was that. And also the other side that I was very surprised by was the sort of the amount of women who came to me after I was outed who said, please continue doing what you're doing. You're a voice out there that we need. We relate to what you're saying, and we feel that, you know, it's an important thing to say. And if you stop saying it, then it prevents us from being able to say the same thing. And so it sort of became, it felt like it became more important to continue talking about sex, not about myself necessarily, because of the conversations and the dialogues that ensued about being sex positive, and that hiding away and pretending that it hadn't happened, because my life was in ruins at that point after I was outed, wasn't an option, because the message was more important than me. So that came as a surprise that there were thousands of women contacted me, and it was overwhelming, the support, and I was so moved, really, really moved.
You mentioned this in your talk, but it was brilliant, the article in The Telegraph with Kate Winslet and your response to that. Is that endemic?
Well, I think, unfortunately, if you're a woman, you're a target, and that can be for the cellulite you have in your thighs through to what partners you've decided to have in your life. It's, you're just an open target for the media to attack. And this is what I was trying to say, was that it's not always about the sort of slut shaming of women for being actively sexual. It's just about being female in the public eye and being open, having, unfortunately, to being open to that criticism. But it's almost always sexist and the double standards, particularly when it comes to sex or relationships. It's completely hypocritical and so frustrating that it just hasn't changed, you know. And you could argue it hasn't changed for decades. The language has changed, and the amount that we experience because of the web, and the fact that it's constant all the time, 24 hours a day. But the same critiques of women will continue, I suppose, which is a very depressing way of looking at it, unless we actively challenge it.
Do you feel like you have a slightly greater voice, a greater kind of call to power, or can speak to power, because the Telegraph article came out and then you got to give a response in the Telegraph, and I guess as a blogger before you may have not been given that power?
In terms of the platform, yes, the platform is there, I'm guessing, because of the notoriety of the blog, and I therefore will exploit it to my benefit, you know. So if I can be in a position to write an article which is absolutely challenging one previously, pointing out how sexist it is, then I will do that. And if a newspaper wants to print it, then great. I wouldn't say it's always the best platform. There are 200-300 comments on the piece that I wrote in The Telegraph a couple of days ago, and they're read them, but, you know, have a glass of whiskey on the side. They're awful and horrendous and personal attacks against me, and I generally won't read comments anymore. I used to as a blogger, but being on a public platform, i.e. Newspaper websites, you're open to much, much more personal attack. I would never allow anything like that on my own blog. I would have just deleted it or challenged it and pointed out what assholes they are. So I don't think I deserve any of that abuse that I got on The Telegraph, but it's not up to me to moderate it or interact with it, for that matter. So I wrote my piece. It's out there. I was very public about my criticism of the earlier Telegraph piece on Twitter and on other forms of social media. And the sexist abuse on The Telegraph should be challenged, but it's not up to me to do that. I'm one person with a voice, and The Telegraph could have been a lot more proactive in getting rid of the abusive stuff.
What are the best ways to engage as a feminist activist online?
That's a really hard question because there's so many different ways of doing it. I mean, I think it's about using your voice and connecting with others and feeling solidarity and strength. I think it's quite hard to do it in isolation. Not shutting anyone out, not shutting anyone down. I mean, I think there's different sides to it. Being inclusive, you know, the argument for being intersectional is an absolutely, you know, definite one. We need we need feminism to be inclusive of others, and people have genuine anger about feeling shut out, so they should. I also dislike a lot of the hatred that has been spread, I suppose, and arguments that your kind of feminism isn't my kind of feminism, and I think that infighting can be quite damaging to women and to feminism. That we need to be inclusive and understanding that there are different approaches, but as a whole we need to move forward as a unit because we're all fighting for equality. And I don't like to see women denigrating other women. I, you know, that there are justifications to that. I think Louise Mensch often brings criticism on herself for her very anti-women views, and then tells us she's a feminist. But, you know, and I'm going to contradict myself here and say, well, her feminism doesn't represent me. But I'm not going to attack her because she, you know, I will criticise her politics, but I'm not going to, I would never say anything personal to attack her because there's no point. Why be like that? Why be misogynist about another woman just because I don't agree with the politics?
Cool. And what was it like speaking at the conference? It seems like a fairly safe space. I always find it interesting being here that there's far more kind of out there, more radical ideas presented at a conference than you would find elsewhere.
It's a great conference. I definitely want to come next year. It's just so many good talks and so many interesting people, and the Q&A afterwards is brilliant. You know, I love that interaction, and I loved that comment made by, I don't know if you were there at the end of my talk, by the older woman who said that she had, you know, loved having sex and love, you know, enjoyed both her husbands. And I just thought her comments were that was my favourite bit.
That was the best of the conference, I think.
Yes, I think
we
so too.
We had sex before Lady Chatterley.
Yes.
Lovers. That was excellent.
Yeah, it was great. It's such a lovely atmosphere as well, being amongst like-minded people, obviously. So
it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now, speaking of conferences, over in America again, they recently held the controversial Women in Secularism conference. Our American correspondent, Chris Hofstadter, went along and whilst there managed to grab a chat for a few minutes with atheist singer-songwriter Shelley Siegel.
Say that I need to be saved. Say with me the devil got his way. You know that someone is listening to what you are saying. So you think that you can tell us how to live our lives, never questioning the thoughts from which your moral core derives. You think that suffering is part of some great plan that's been devised. I wonder
you've taken on the piece where we're marrying art and secularism and humanism and feminism and such. How did you come to do that?
Well, I've been writing music since I was 11 years old. I'm 26 now. Then I became an atheist probably when I was 19 years old, when I was travelling. And I came home and I had a bit of distance and time from my religion, and I started to, I guess, take issue with some of the religious doctrines that I'd grown up with, and I started to read the work of the New Atheist. The first book I read was Richard Carrier's Sense and Goodness Without God, A Defense of Metaphysical Naturalism, which is a fantastic book. And so I started to realize the value of critical thinking and logic and reason, and I started to get involved in secular activism. So kind of as a songwriter, the natural progression is that you'll start writing about the issues that are important to you and what you're facing and dealing with in your life at that time. So, yeah, that's what I did, and I made a record called An Atheist Album.
In preparation, I listened to the whole album this morning, and there were a number of places where songs really jumped out at me. And I have to say, I think the song Gratitude was one of the most elegant representations of a personal view of how one can be good without God.
I wrote that song on a long road trip. I went to visit the Stromatolites in Western Australia. And basically the Stromatolites were the earliest life form on the planet. They existed 3.5 billion years ago. And they were a cyanobacteria that lived in the ocean, and they washed up on the shore, and over thousands of years they would collect and form these rock-like structures that they look like rocks, but they were alive, they were bacteria, and they had this chemical reaction that would release oxygen. And so these stromatolites are responsible for oxygenating the early earth. I got out on the pier and I looked over and I could see the rocks, and I looked for long enough and a little bubble of oxygen came out, and I had this really meaningful and significant transcendent experience where I just felt this deep sense of gratitude. So it was very moving, and on the way home in the car, I wrote the song Gratitude in my head about that experience and that deep sense that I felt.
I enjoyed your songs, House Without Walls. Was that a greater statement on a broader skepticism, or was that specific to just humanism and atheism?
Well, I think that it came from a place of being directed at someone who didn't believe in evolution. And I think it's about someone that doesn't want to let go of their beliefs, not for their truth value, but because of the comfort that it brings them, for the way that it makes them feel. And I think, so while it was directed at, you know, an atheist kind of issue, it does, I think, speak to a broader skepticism.
In addition, you're also a feminist. And, you know, how did a nice Jewish girl, you know, find her way to feminism?
It's really been a recent thing. I definitely identify as a feminist, but it's funny, I came to my feminism through my atheism. I guess one of the first things that really struck me when I kind of started to really think about issues like secularism, and, you know, I'd become an atheist, but I still considered myself Jewish. I still thought Judaism was really important part of my identity. I still thought that, oh, religion's not for me, but it's a great force for good in the world. And I started to question these ideas, and also really my whole worldview, because I'd stopped believing in God, but there were still some beliefs I'd held on to. Like, I still thought I was going to heaven. I still believed in ghosts. And I hadn't really realized that so much of my worldview was based on bollocks, technical term. So then I realized, oh, there's science, and there's this tool, and there's this way we can look at the world, and I've kind of been lied to in this way, and so much of the way I see the world is constructed by the people, and I have tools to learn for myself and find new things out. And so I guess gender was the next thing to kind of come under the microscope. So I started to read a bit more about feminism and read some strong female voices in the movement, which was very inspiring, because I think coming from a patriarchal religion, we don't really get strong, opinionated, outgoing female role models. And so this is the first time being in this movement that I've really been exposed to that, and it's amazing how powerful and how liberating and motivating that just having women on stage in that kind of role can be.
Now, looping back to the beginning, my friend Amy Davis Roth, Surly Amy of Shirley Ramix is really, really interested in the intersection of art and secularism and feminism, mm. skepticism. She does the blog Mad Art Lab, which is feminist artists and such all doing stuff there. And thinking more in the broader thing, how do you see art and music delivering these messages, and what is their importance to the movement?
I think it's absolutely vital. Any subculture, any kind of movement is going to be reflected in art, because that's what people do. They reflect their lives and their experiences through art. And like I said, for a person who's an art consumer, that is really vital to be experiencing your worldview through these mediums. And I like to quote a Kimya Dawson song. I don't know if you're a Kimya fan. She's pretty cool. But she has this line that I use sometimes when people say, don't you think you're just singing to the choir? You're preaching to the choir. And I say, well, Kimya Dawson's line in her song is, I'm not preaching to the choir, I'm singing with the choir. And I like that. I feel like this kind of movement towards cultural representation of our beliefs and our worldviews is a representation, and it's us kind of expressing that together and motivating each other.
Now, recently there's been news of a new app which claims to be able to cure homosexuality. But does it actually work? Tom Morris this week has been conducting an experiment.
In the last week or so, there's been a bit of a fuss on the internet about a smartphone app called Setting Captives Free, which promises to turn gay people straight in 60 days or less. The gay rights campaigning group AllOut.org have launched a petition to both Apple and Google to have Setting Captives Free removed from the App Store and Google's Play Store. Following the petition, Apple have removed the app, but Google haven't yet done so. All Out described the app as harmful, noting that efforts to change sexual orientation have been denounced by doctors and psychiatrists as both ineffective and dangerous. Now, I've been in the closet, and I know how hard it can be. The way to help closeted and confused young gay and lesbian people is to help them build up the self-confidence and self-love to come out and live open and honest lives, not to try and hide away or try and convert. It doesn't work, and it makes people miserable. Except there's a problem. That pesky free speech thing. Most people agree that we should allow a wide range of speech in a liberal society, including things I personally find distasteful, like gay to straight therapy. So I'm not totally sure what to think. I decided to try the app out for myself. The mobile app is just a counterpart to the website, which offers courses to help you stop smoking, self-harming, gambling, overeating, masturbating, watching pornography, and, yes, being gay. Strangely enough, the phone app features all of the courses except the gay to straight one, Door of Hope. I went through the first week of lessons on the app for the anti-pornography course at some speed to see how it worked. Quite a lot of it is about the Bible and requires quite boring Bible study and answering lots of questions. You fill the answers in on your phone and submit them back to your mentor at Setting Captives Free. Only I didn't. I kind of cheated and just did the preview, which doesn't let you submit stuff back. You should ideally sign up if you're going to turn straight. I switched over to my laptop, which lets me actually do the Door of Hope, the gay to straight course. Amazingly, the course was basically the same, except it didn't have personal testimony from some, you know, formerly masturbating person. It had a formerly gay person telling me all about the many woes he faced while in the sexual lifestyle of homosexuality. This gives you some idea about how Setting Captives Free works. It doesn't matter whether it's porn or overeating or being gay. They have a set plan that will set you free. The quote from the course material, The grace and love of God is the cure for any bondage. Notice I said any bondage. Homosexuality is not a special case. Freedom from it may be accomplished through the same methods God has provided for all sins. Sin is a spiritual problem and requires a spiritual solution. God's grace given to us at the cross of Jesus Christ is the solution. It isn't until you get a bit further into it that they ramp up on the anti-gay stuff more explicitly. So on day 17, for instance, "Dear friend, we need to separate ourselves completely from whatever has been enticing us into homosexual behaviour, or even anything promoting homosexual thoughts, feelings or desires." They describe this as amputating yourself in the same way as the line from the New Testament about plucking out your eye. Let's see, anything that promotes homosexual thoughts? So that would be men, pictures of men, seeing men in society and on TV and on the bus. The cure for my being gay requires that I separate myself from half of the human race, apparently. The course goes on. I don't have to tell you how many thousands of people, mostly men, have paid for their involvement in homosexuality with their lives due to AIDS. In some cases, homosexuality takes people into the dark and sordid realm of sadomasochism. You know who else has gotten AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases? The unaware straight partners of gay men who've been brainwashed by silly gay to straight courses into thinking they could be reborn as good straight Christian people. And you know who hasn't been punished? Lesbians. God loves lesbians. As for sadomasochism, I have plenty of friends who seem to have been dragged into the dark and sordid realm, despite being completely heterosexual. It's almost as if the two things are separate. The course then asks me to list what things have caused you to sin in the area of homosexuality. I sat there for a minute with a small box on my phone thinking, what do I type in here? Tom Daly? Ryan Gosling? Cher? The New Kids on the Block? Lady Gaga? Well, the New Kids on the Block isn't me, that's a friend. Really. The course then tells me I'm spiritually pitch black. It is spiritually pitch black in the life of someone involved in homosexuality. His or her lusts are continually stirred up by visual images that have been burned into the mind, whether from pornography or actual sexual encounters. Yes, my lusts are continually stirred up by visual images from pornography, from sexual encounters, and from just seeing attractive people on the street. The author of this course seems to think that A, this is somehow exclusive to gay men. Sorry, men involved in homosexuality, since it's just something we're involved in rather than something that forms kind of a key part of lots of people's identity. And B, that that's a bad thing. The former is untrue. My heterosexual male friends tell me that their lusts are continually stirred up by attractive women. And the latter is silly, because there's kind of nothing wrong with finding attractive people attractive. The course later goes on to tell me that I'm a rebellious person. Depends on your definition of rebellious, I guess. Deceitful. I'd rather hope not. Unwilling to listen to godly instruction. Absolutely, and proud of it. And that I do not wish to be confronted about my sin. Well, duh. They go on. All who continue pursuing homosexuality will find that their lives will come crashing down to the ground and be smashed to pieces. This may take the form of losing a wife and child to divorce. For some who continue to pursue homosexuality for a lifetime, the result is that they will find themselves old, forgotten and alone in their declining years. For the even less fortunate, their declining years occur while still young due to AIDS and other STDs ravaging their body. They seem to not see the problem here. It is precisely because of the advocacy of those who demand that gay people change that they are led into sham marriages. If gay people are living out in the open and having relationships with one another without shame, there's no wife and children, except for the lesbians, because there's no sham marriages. Of course, I may be rather biased here, based on personal experience. My life has pretty much only improved as a result of being honest with myself and coming out. Far from having my life come crashing down, coming out has helped me better be myself and make better decisions about things like work and health. And it's made life more fun. Later in the course, it cites a verse from the Psalms that actually sums up the difference between being in the closet and out of it. For when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. Yeah, that's pretty much it. But again, there's that free speech thing. I find it very difficult to work out what I think. On the one hand, I object to the power that big companies like Apple and Google can exercise over their app marketplaces, and I do find it rather strange that we seem to treat apps so differently from how we treat books or films. Apple would allow this to be published within the iBooks store without issue, or publish it as a podcast in iTunes. If they made a video version of Setting Captives free, YouTube would probably publish it. Much as I personally object on aesthetic grounds to so-called apps that are just blobs of content, publish a damn web page rather than requiring me to download an executable file, it seems strange to have a regulatory regime, albeit a non-governmental one, set up where creating an app means you're subject to extra scrutiny than if you produce an ebook or a film or a podcast. That said, while I found reading through Setting Captives Free often quite hilarious, comparing, for instance, the implied picture of the very scary homosexual with the rather more mundane reality of my own life, I can see how, to a deeply closeted person with a religious background, some of the messages in Door of Hope would lead to serious mental challenges. Not only do so-called sexual orientation change efforts not work, they're often harmful. The writers are trying to get people to believe that the people who take this course are no longer homosexuals, but are just subject to homosexual temptations. Well, darling, if you have homosexual temptations, that kind of means you're gay. I have another moral inconsistency here. As most skeptics do, I think we should regulate and prevent access to dangerous alternative medicine. Someone going around telling people to not take their cancer medication and stick coffee up their bum? Throw them in jail! Someone claiming magic herbs are medicine? Well, they need to prove their case through the same system of pharmaceutical regulation as the rest of medicine. The problem is that this is basically unlicensed psychotherapy. Really bad psychotherapy that does more harm than good. But because it takes the form of media, an app in this case, it isn't subject to any regulation. And I'm not sure it should be. Again, free speech. But drawing the line between a gay-to-straight phone app and a dodgy medicine is quite hard, because speech is mental medicine, and some medicine can be harmful. The more you think about it, the harder these issues become. It may be that all we might be able to do is just loudly speak out against so-called ex-gay therapy, point out the hypocrisies and utter failure of it, keep pointing out the ex-gay leaders who seem to end up cruising gay bars and hiring rent boys while preaching about how they've become free of their homosexual demons through Bible thumping. Anyway, I have to end this by admitting to my failure. The course kind of didn't really work. Despite having gone through 30 days of the turn away from the gay course, I'm still quite a big fan of... Oh well. This is Tom Morris, hoping that they play Lady Gaga in hell. For the Pod Delusion.
The chief rabbi this week has been talking rubbish in The Spectator. He reckons that atheism has failed. But actually has it? I'm not so sure I can believe it. And nor can Sam Burns, who explains some of the problems with Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' opinions in this next report.
In an article in The Spectator titled "Atheism Has Failed, Only Religion Can Defeat the New Barbarians," chief Judaistic pugilist Rabbi Jonathan Sacks adopted a unique way of making his point. He didn't. Thus demonstrating the power of miracles. If he can demonstrate that atheism has failed by not doing that, then this is obviously a miracle. Ergo, God exists. Or, in the Dr. William Lane Craig mode of argument, premise is that God exists, and that if there is a God, then miracles exist, and seeing that miracles exist, therefore God exists. This represents compelling evidence that God exists. So therefore, on atheism, you have to believe that God doesn't exist. But as we have seen, God does exist, and atheism has provided no positive evidence to the contrary. Therefore, God exists and atheism is false. That's a knockdown argument, don't you know? You see, logic is wonderful, isn't it? Unfortunately, this line of reasoning is countered quite successfully by the argument from Babelfish. But wait, despite all this logicality, it turns out it is really bad. It caused the Holocaust, the Communist Manifesto, racism, and presumably Justin Bieber. Despite sticking its fingers in its ears and incessantly shouting no at you through YouTube, religion is on the wane. Big time. It used to be that thing you got up all dressed for on Sunday so you could go sing boring songs and pray for your eternal soul because your mortal one was having a pretty dull time. Nowadays, people just sit around eating toast, watching Andrew Marr, and winding down until about 6 o'clock when desperation kicks in because you've still got to do your washing for work in the morning. And if you really want to be preached at, you can buy the mail on Sunday. Which brings us to the one institution in quicker decline than religion, print media. Papers, magazines, books, all those things you used to pay for but don't have to anymore because the internet is pretty much free, for now. Well, turns out that they found a trick to sell a few more copies. Scandal, moral depravity and controversy. So it turns out that Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks and The Spectator are a match made in heaven. Atheism is the gift that keeps on giving. The Chief Rabbi can scream about things that he couldn't get people to listen to if he screwed their earlobes to a BMR in his synagogue, and The Spectator gets a controversial, if nonsensical, headline and can bang on about moral depravity by proxy. Nice win all round, really. Atheism is a relatively meaningless term that suggests nothing about the universe other than it is as it appears to be in relation to a god or gods. To suggest it has failed is to give it similar qualities to a political movement or a religion. And it can't be a religion because that is exactly what Dr. Sacks is saying we need or are lacking. Imagine the headline, Stamp Collecting Has Failed. Or, Sitting on Chairs Repudiated. Hardly controversial in that they are obviously meaningless phrases. What he actually means is, secularism or humanism has failed. Terms that he uses fairly interchangeably with atheism because he likes to bring a subtle nuance to his argument. The Sacks Phillips Pincer, named after Dr. Sacks and Melanie Phillips, by me, is a move where you assert moral sheep are better than moral relativists, and moral relativism is the inevitable result of the Enlightenment and personal rational thinking. All the ills of society, the mugging, murder and pornography, has become permissible because people are judging for themselves what is right and wrong. What's true for me isn't necessarily true for you, type reasoning. And for some reason it therefore follows that we see falling levels of trust in bankers, CEOs, politicians, the press and police, increasing depression and stress, a lack of social cohesion, increased crime rates, and of course, the Holocaust. This then gives you the opportunity to say, but when we put our faith in religion, we can defer to a unified objective morality. Therefore, religion is good. Objective morality is the apologists' favourite trope at the moment. They think they have atheists by the short and curlies. I personally lie awake in fear of that question. But what about objective morality? Barely peeking out from under my duvet in case someone says, but there is only sky above your world. But then I realise I don't need objective morality subjectified for me by, let's say, that beacon of honour and virtue, a Catholic priest. And then I fall into a deep sleep for 3 days and three nights, whereupon I rise, wander around for a bit, and then sit at the right hand of Zod. The Sacks Phillips Pincer is useful to religionists for two reasons. One, it ignores the facts, and two, it doesn't make any sense. A bit like the Old Testament. If you can be suckered in by this line of argument, then you can be suckered in by most lines of scripture. Seeing as Dr. Sacks is so keen to keep this religious nonsense going, what massive successes can we look forward to in the upcoming millennia? The Spanish Inquisition 2, God Gets Angry, a return to more vengeful ways for the singular deity? How about some witch trials? And instead of witches, young girls and women who aren't really witches but are accused of being witches because there's no atheists left to be angry at. After all, they were murdered in the sequel to the Crusades. All you can expect to look forward to on atheism is tedious like understanding, reasoning, inquiry, and exploration. You know, a bit like the Federation in Star Trek. Green space babes aside, there is absolutely no reason why anybody who's into witch trials and murdering abortionist doctors wouldn't dig religion. And that's everybody, isn't it? But, I can imagine Dr. Sacks saying, because humans have evolved decoupled cognition to allow us to think through complex interactions with unseen others. But that's not religion. It is a misinterpretation. Thou shalt not kill applies to doctors as much as anyone else. Whoops, somebody just got caught reasoning, and that's failed, so it's not allowed, sorry. Seeing as the Holocaust is brought up every time the Chief Rabbi has anything to say, was the cause of the Holocaust helped or hindered by moral sheepery? Would the widespread adoption of Enlightenment concepts, like rational, dispassionate, critical thinking, help or hinder the Nazis? What about people trying to accept religious dogma as ethical truth? These serious questions and others like it are missing from Jonathan Sacks' worldview, along with the Scandinavian-shaped black spot in his reasoning. All the secular countries that rank extremely high in everything Dr. Sacks says is lacking from society. High levels of happiness, great place to have kids, great place to grow up, lowest levels of gender inequality, and one of the world leaders of the Global Peace Index. This sort of evidence is unnecessary to counter the rabbi's observation, because moral relativism is fundamentally irrational. In fact, it leads to exactly what he wants. If one point of view is no better than another, then why think at all? The new point of view is as valid as the last, and in truth, when someone adopts that line of reasoning, it's normally because they have lost the argument. Nobody's really a moral relativist because as soon as they deploy said defence, they go about their day asserting all sorts of things are fundamentally true. Every sane person knows that the real solution to this is education. The barbarians have got to come to terms with modernity. Western Christian culture could have a role to play. After all, it's been through the harrowing confrontation with Enlightenment, and it could show the barbarians the way, but the last thing we want is a regress to the Dark Ages. It comes to something when one of our cultural leaders insists that the answer to all our problems is to stop thinking. This is Sam Burns for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, Man of Steel. Chances are that you must have seen it by now. You know, the new Superman film. A film which, like Somalia, makes up for its lack of coherence with a relentless mess of explosions. One of the things about the film that's generating a lot of chat, though, wasn't the fact that a print newspaper had the budget to apparently send a reporter around the world on a hunch, but that it's a bit Jesus-y. But this isn't exactly new to Superman, as Alex Fitch now explains.
Superman is a character who has been presented with increasingly religious overtones in recent years. In terms of religious iconography, this was at its most explicit in the miniseries All-Star Superman, a quarterly American comic book that ran between autumn 2005 and autumn 2008. Issue 10 of the comic showed a godlike Superman dwarfing the planet Earth on the periodical's cover, with the globe hovering between his hands, portraying the superhero as a benevolent deity, metaphorically and literally looking after our planet. This cover was reused as the front of the second paperback collection of the serial, and in 2011, a new oversized hardback of the entire series, and a subsequent paperback printing, featured a newly commissioned cover that more overtly depicts Superman as a sun god, particularly a Christ-like figure, descending from the heavens with the sun shining behind his head. The contents of the comic have perhaps less religious overtones than its covers, but it's interesting to note that a reprint of the first issue of this comic has been given away at Sears shops in America, plus various bookshops and cinemas to promote the new movie. The most conspicuous manifestation of Superman at the moment, though, is Zack Snyder's film Man of Steel. The movie's name comes from one of Superman's nicknames, and is probably named to partially differentiate it from the Christopher Reeve films of the 1980s, and particularly their belated sequel in 2006, but also given this name to follow the tradition of the two most recent Batman films, which also didn't have his name in their titles, but also used that character's nickname The Dark Knight instead. The other connection with the Dark Knight films is the presence of their writer-director Christopher Nolan as producer-stroke-co-writer of Man of Steel. In Nolan's Batman trilogy, one of his aims was to make comic book films that were based around the human rather than the fantastical, something one might argue is at odds with the comic itself. But in his Batman, the character's enemy, Ra's al Ghul, is no longer an immortal, and Batman himself is more like James Bond. Being human and having human enemies is obviously an approach that cannot be entirely applied to Superman, his nemesis Lex Luthor notwithstanding. And with this new adaptation, the filmmakers have taken the opposite approach, with a lengthy introduction to the people and warfare of Krypton, providing the film with the most science fiction approach to Superman seen on screen so far. However, once this considerable prologue is over, the film takes an almost immediate turn towards the messianic. Although there were flashbacks throughout the film to young Clark Kent's experiences, once the recreation of his spaceship's arrival on Earth is shown, it cuts to a scene 33 years later, where a bearded Clark, ostensibly in the wilderness, reluctantly performs miracles, as it were, in conflict with his desire to stay hidden amongst humanity. This could equally be described as a trope from a variety of superhero films. However, throughout Man of Steel, there are references, particularly in the flashback scenes, where young Clark is described as being here to save us. The film also has a scene where Superman goes to a church for guidance and talks to a young priest about the potential results of his actions that he's planning to take. Another heavily loaded line of dialogue has his adopted father Jonathan saying, "Your father sent you here for a reason." It's strange that the film doesn't show the famous scene where the Kents come across the baby in his spaceship cradle, as that could also have been given a hint of the Magi visiting the Christ child. Perhaps that might be in the deleted scenes on the eventual DVD. In terms of iconography, though, it's interesting to note that when quizzed about why the film wasn't called Superman Begins or whatever, the filmmaker said that the hero's S logo, as featured on his suit, was enough to let people know that this was a film starring the last son of Krypton, and that the logo was the second most widely recognizable symbol in the world after the Christian cross. The plot of the film, which sees Clark, or Kal-El if you prefer, torn between saving the legacy of Krypton, according to the methods of General Zod, and saving humanity, sees him obviously choosing the latter, with most of the film being taken up with both him and the human army fighting super-powered Kryptonians in scenes of what are increasingly being described as disaster porn by connoisseurs of modern action movies. I'm not a psychologist, so I wouldn't like to comment on why recreations of 9/11 on screen are now a staple of Hollywood blockbusters. But in a year that has seen a huge number of films set before, during, and after the end times of humanity, it seems that the apocalypse has become de rigueur as a subject for the movie industry at the moment. I don't want to spoil the film more than I have to for the content of this essay, but the scenes of city destruction in this film, of both Superman's most famous fictional American locations, seem to be setting up a sequel where the events of this installment will have a profound effect on the psyche of the country depicted in the film. Either by accident or design, this seems to be following in the footsteps of Joss Whedon's Avengers, where the so-called New York incident of that film has been an influence on the psyche of Tony Stark in the subsequent Iron Man 3, and is also a reflection on the aforementioned 9/11 motif in current action films. The post-Kryptonian battle scenes in Man of Steel, though, have a particular scorched earth feel to them. As if this imagery wasn't enough, an earlier dream sequence sees Superman imagining himself sinking through an apocalyptic field of human skulls. This scene is borrowed from a similar episode of Smallville, where a flash forward predicts Lex Luthor as president and sees him in a field of bones. And another iconic image that Man of Steel borrows from a previous incarnation of the franchise is a godlike vision of Superman floating beatifically above the Earth, previously featured in, and on posters for, the previous movie, Superman Returns. At least Man of Steel doesn't borrow the imagery of a crucified teenage Clark Kent, which appeared in the pilot episode of Smallville in 2001. Whether all of this Christian imagery was present in the earliest drafts of the film script or not is unknown to this critic, but certainly Warner Brothers have capitalized on these aspects by giving their approval to a website, manofsteelresources.com, where pastors and ministers can use the film to engage church audiences in screenings and compare events in the movie to the life of Jesus. One of the downloadable lessons on the website is entitled Jesus, More Than Our Superman, and begins, "Kids will better appreciate Jesus and his sacrifice through looking at scripture and the parallels in the Man of Steel movie." One of the parallels given is that Superman realizes he must fight to save the Earth and stay to keep saving the Earth. Christ didn't just give himself over to reverse the judgment against us. He did that, then rose victorious, and continues to fight for us. Man of Steel would have been well in production before producers might have noticed that the recent Bible TV series had been a massive hit. But the Christian audience is one surprisingly overlooked by film and TV makers. The last film made ostensibly for a Christian audience, Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, made over $600 million worldwide, a 20 times return on the $30 million that the film cost to make. An article in Forbes magazine published in 2004, in the week of Gibson's film's release, speculated that Christian audiences would lap up both the film and the merchandise, with the Christian retail market worth an estimated $4.2 billion at that time. The 2010 movie The Last Exorcism cost $1.8 million and made over $60 million at the box office, and the trailer for the forthcoming sequel suggests the religious overtones have been increased for the follow-up. Films actually bankrolled by church groups have only had meagre successes. 1999's The Omega Code, starring Casper Van Diem and Michael York, funded by the Trinity Broadcasting Network, only made a $6 million profit. And the year 2000's film Left Behind, starring Growing Pains actor Kirk Cameron and former Marlborough man Brad Johnson, only made a $200,000 profit. But that didn't stop either movie receiving sequels. But perhaps it takes either a star like Gibson or a franchise like Superman to successfully bridge the gap between God and Mammon, at least on the big screen. It's ironic that The Last Exorcism was produced by Jewish filmmaker Eli Roth, and Superman himself created by two Jewish second-generation émigrés, who perhaps were able to enjoy some small revenge against the Nazis who were invading their parents' homelands of Lithuania and the Ukraine, in their four-color strip adventures where the Man of Steel fought German soldiers in both the pages of Action Comics and in cinema cartoons from 1942 onwards. If you want to look for modern-day parallels with the war against terror, I guess Zod and his cohorts could be seen as extremists or fundamentalists, but regardless of these plot elements, it'll be interesting where they take the Christian iconography in any sequels. Certainly superheroes with religious overtones on screen are not a new idea. Neo, in 1999's The Matrix, has a messianic quality to him, as does Peter Parker in 2004's Spider-Man 2, where after a grueling confrontation with villain Dr. Octopus on a train, the hero is gently carried to the ground by the people of New York, as if they were carrying Christ off the cross. However, Man of Steel is the most overtly Christian depiction of a superhero on the big screen so far. While overtly Christian depictions of Superman on the page, to wink-wink cover art, and bootleg Superman comics such as Rich Johnson's The Flying Friar, perhaps the success of Man of Steel, which made its $220 million budget back in its opening weekend, means the messianic overtones of this latest installment will be just the tip of the iceberg. Time will tell. This has been Alex Fitch, spreading the word for The Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3.5 years' worth of podcast archives, as well as hear podcasts from the BHA conference and their talks in full as soon as I've got around to editing them. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. And whilst there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making this show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Julie Gould, Liz Luckendorf, Chris Hofstadter, Tom Morris, Sam Burns, Alex Fitch, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Have a word.
Of course. How are things in planning?
I can't complain. Well, not since we had to cut the complaints department.
Anyway, what can I do for you?
Well, Johnson, we're all a little concerned about your management of the town high street.
Really? I thought I'd been filling the vacant units quickly and efficiently.
Well, that is true, but what you've been doing is filling them up with betting shops, Johnson.
Supply and demand. People need to have their hopes and dreams, sir.
But gambling is such a long shot, Johnson.
Bet you it isn't, sir.
Shut up, Johnson. Look, there are 17 betting shops on this high street alone. Once you've got past the butchers, what do we see? Ladbrokes, Betfred, Betfair, Ladbrokes, Ladbrokes, Jennings, Coral, Paddy Power, Metrobet, Ladbrokes again.
It's not my fault. The law limits betting shops to 4 fixed stake gambling machines per unit. It's profitable enough for them to open multiple stores in the same street. Don't hate the player, sir. Hate the game.
Yes, very street, Johnson. But don't you think this short-term gain is having a negative long-term effect on the community?
Well, that's the gamble, sir. But I'm filling my quotas.
What about other types of shop, Johnson?
It's not like we haven't tried, sir. But the pound shop got put out of business by the 99p store, and that's facing stiff opposition from the 98p emporium.
Look, there's one more vacant unit between Ladbrokes and Jennings. Can we at least...
An empty unit, sir? I'll put you on hold for a moment, if you don't mind. Now, give the planning committee a nudge, again, and yes, we can put another Ladbrokes in there.
Another Ladbrokes? But Johnson, that's...
I know, sir. What are the odds, eh? 3 Ladbrokes in a row, jackpot!
Good work, Johnson. Now, come with me. I've got my eye on another street that's due to pay out any minute.